Welcome and happy Valentine's Day, members and guests, to the February 14th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, the City Club president. Today, our sponsors are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students in grades 7 to 12, Oakley Meadow Co-Housing, an intergenerational community designed for simple, sustainable living, KRVM, and a special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night, and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax-deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. As we enter this tax season, a reminder that by matching your membership with a contribution to the Oregon Cultural Trust earmarking the City Club of Eugene, you may receive a tax credit on next year's taxes for the value of both. Today's presenter is Bob Welch, who will discuss his farewell speech. Farewell to newspapers, what I learned in four decades on the beat. Today's organizer is Marlene Nasseri. And here's retired Register Guard columnist and reportedly noted poker player, Don Bischoff, to introduce our speaker.
I think I probably first encountered Bob Welch 30-some years ago when we were on opposing touch football teams. He was playing for the Oregon Daily Emerald team, and I was playing for the Register Guard team, and I think he probably knocked me down at some point. So I'd like to say that I, for one, am glad that Bob Welch has retired from the Register Guard. I retired 15 years ago, yesterday, February 13th, 1999, and Bob took up the Register Guard columnist job later the same year. Ever since then, I've been comparing myself to Bob and have consistently found myself wanting. Take mountain climbing. Bob doesn't just climb a mountain. He starts out at the Oregon coast fishing. He plays golf along the way up the McKenzie, and then he climbs the mountain all in one day. I climbed one mountain once, South Sister. Our guide got lost on the way up, and I reached the top exhausted. I glissaded, is that the word? I glissaded part of the way down on a snowfield and wore a big hole in the seat of my pants, meaning I had to hike out at the rest of the way at the rear of our party to avoid embarrassment. Then on the way home, the transmission went out of my car and I had to borrow a car from a friend in Bend. Finally, on the way back down the McKenzie Highway after almost 24 hours without sleep, I kept swerving off the road because I was hallucinating the big rig trucks were coming at me in my lane. So that's why I don't climb mountains like Bob Welch. Which reminds me, I am supposed to introduce Bob here, aren't I? So, I should tell you that he's been a newsman for a total of 37 years and has written 17 books while turning out three columns a week for the Register Guard. 17 books. It was all I could do to crank out three columns a week and no books. I could never sustain a thought beyond 20 column inches. Twice, Bob won the top award from the National Society of Newspaper Columnists. In 38 years of trying, I never got an honorable mention. Bob also taught journalism at the U of O while doing those three-a-week columns. I tried teaching at the U of O once, and I ran out of lecture notes 15 minutes into my first class. Bob gives in for inspirational speeches. I tried public speaking once when I was asked to give a humorous talk at the Elmira Grange Fair. Nobody laughed. Bob writes letters to his grandchildren signed Bob Bob. He has a Facebook page called Pebble in the Water Inspiration, a Twitter account, a writer's workshop, and a Wikipedia listing. I don't. So enough about Bob. I can't take any more of the comparison, but lest you think he is universally loved, I leave you with the words of an email he says he once got. Quote, in the supermarket of ideas, you are the 7-Eleven. Bob Welch.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, that was a memorable one. There was one about you, about something about no tree should give its life for the newsprint that your column is run on, but Well, Bischoff was and is still an institute in this city, and we're very different columnists, different passions, different strengths, and honored to have been introduced by him. And I remember that flag football story the other way around. He was a lineman, I was a wide receiver. I remember him knocking me down. But at any rate, and one other point, you know, I did a book event up at a Jansen Beach at Barnes & Noble, and after 2 hours, nobody showed up. So Don's making me sound a little bit more important than I should be. Finally, as the store is closing, a woman shuffled over and said, oh, will you sign my book? Will you sign my book? She handed me a book. It's not a book that I had written. But at that point, you're pretty desperate. So, you know, you at least contemplate the idea of pretending like you're the author of the book on goat cheese and talking about some of your favorite cheeses and such. But at any rate, well, it's good to be here. I'm glad you all survived the interesting 2014 weather. We had a couple of weeks of fog, and then we, of course, had snow and freezing rain and ice. And I guess the forecast this weekend is for frogs and locusts. My talk today is kind of a blend. I got a little bit confused about what I was supposed to talk about. I thought because it was Oregon's birthday today, 155th birthday, I would talk a little bit about Oregon, and then it's going to be kind of a little bit of a hybrid. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about 37 years in the newspaper business. So in 2008, when the Olympic trials were coming here, I wanted to impress upon people visiting from other states what an amazing place this is physically. And so I said, you know what, you could start your day in Florence, in Lane County, watching a sunrise. Of course, it would be looking back to the east over the mountains. So you could watch that sunrise. You could drive into Eugene, have breakfast at the Glenwood. You could drive farther east and fly fish the McKenzie River, play nine holes of golf at Tokadee, drive around through Bend, come up, hike the 10,353-foot South Sister, and watch a sunset from the top, all in the same day, all in the same county. And then the next year, I decided, I wonder if you really could do that. Now, I had checked with Bill Sullivan, and he assured me that it was probably possible. But at any rate, I got my son and my brother-in-law, and they agreed to do it, and we did it. You know, 6:11, I think we left the surf at Florence, and 6:27 p.m., we were standing atop the South Sister. And I remember as we came down, the weather was fascinating. Everything right at the crest of the Cascades to the west was just a bowl of clam chowder clouds, and everything to the east was pure blue. And as I was coming down that crest, I just was amazed at what an amazing place this is. And I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up tramping around the Cascades with my dad. And so a lot of my columns tend to be about Oregon. And every February 14th birthday, like today, I would always write about the state of Oregon. And I'm just going to some of the things that were fun to write about. We asked readers to name rain for us. We came up with over 100 names for rain, including Peter Stratton's Drist, on the low end between mist and drizzle, enough to dampen your Pendleton wool shirt, but not your spirits. And of course, filibuster, rain and strong wind that go on and on. Mary Snyder of Oak Ridge offered that one. We came up with words that weren't in the Oregon language dictionary, but should be, like hydrospine, the line of spray on the back of a bicyclist riding a bike with no rear fender, and bish and chips, a name given to a coastal poker parties involving a former Register Guard columnist. We named Hayworth Saddle, readers did, that saddle in the Coburg Hills that I always would drive by and say, that's got to have a name. But it didn't. And it was an interesting process. So we opened up nominations, and then we had readers vote on it. And then I went up to the Oregon Geographic Board's name and made this PowerPoint presentation. After, you have to check with the BLM and Weyerhaeuser, the people who own the land, and Native Americans and museums and all. It's quite a process. And then they approved it 16-1 up there in Portland. And then it went to the federal level, and they agreed that it would be Hayworth Saddle. And it was just fun to see that people, we could do something. We could name a geographic feature. And I always try to have some fun with the weather around here. I just want to read a few stanzas. Back in 2007, it was extremely cold for about a week. So I took with the liberty of Robert Service and his poem, The Cremation of Sam McGee. I wrote, there are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. But the frozen north, like the Firth of Forth, has no lock on weather insane, for who will forget the recent cold hit taken by County of Lane? The snow and ice lashed, so cocky and brash, snowball soon being lobbed. And then came the hustle and earnest bustle from the tire boys at Les Schwab. 'Twas January mild when we started to skid, January mid when we started to skid on the morn and evening commutes. The temperature plunged and events were expunged from Butte to whitened Butte. From offshore it came, a storm much acclaimed by Fisher, Calbreath, and Chewy, while transplants rolled eyes and proudly did sigh. This a storm? That's pure Huey. But others worried as snowflakes flurried and in typical overreaction slapped on their chains from Coburg to Drain in a desperate search for traction. It was just always fun to, and just like people say, do you miss the column? I kind of missed the column like last weekend during the storm because I go, oh, I would write something about that. But now I don't do that. So it's been fun. I decided in honor of the 155th, I would also offer some trivia about Oregon that I found interesting over the years. Here's five obscure Oregonians. Number one, Carolyn Davidson. Anybody know of her? Okay, that means she's obscure. 1972, 32-year-old graphic design student at Portland State University. A guy came to her and said, I have a new company and I need a logo for it. Could you help me make the logo? Of course, she designed the Nike swoosh. Her invoice, $35. I understand that she got a pretty good pile of stock after Nike actually took off. Number two, obscure Oregonian, Richard Chambers. Father of the Oregon bottle bill. A logging equipment salesman from Salem, 1968, he had gone for a walk on Nestucca Spit on the coast, and there'd been garbage out there, bottles and stuff, and he came back and he was reading the paper and he just suddenly said, that's it. He had read an article about a British Columbia lawmaker who had proposed banning non-returnable bottles. He said, we ought to do that here in Oregon. And so this logging equipment salesman led the fight, got some legislatures interested, and in 1971, the Oregon's bottle bill became the first in the nation, and Chambers himself died in 74. But Richard Chambers, somebody we should always remember. Number three would be Belle Fountain's 1937 basketball team, sort of the Hoosiers of Oregon. 29 students, two teachers. Back in the day when all of this, there were not different divisions for the high school teams, went all the way, beat Franklin and Lincoln, each of which had more than 1,000 students in them to win the state title in basketball. They were the Hoosiers of Oregon. And of course, Abigail Scott Duniway, who fought for 40 years for the right of women to vote, often against her brother, Harvey Scott, who was the editor of the Oregonian. And she won in 1912. That right was won. Oregon was the ninth state to allow women to vote. And she died at 80, but not before voting. So, and of course, fifth, some of you have to know Walter Umenhofer. Bischoff, you do.
He was the owner of a Buick, I believe, that was struck by a piece of the exploding whale.
Exactly. He wasn't, and it was an Oldsmobile Regency 98, but yeah, he was the guy in 1970 when the State Department, Highway Department thought the way to get rid of a 45-foot dead whale was to blow it up with dynamite. He was the guy who took the brunt of it with a 4-foot piece that landed on his Oldsmobile roof. And his son is now, works for the Springfield Police Department. Anyway, okay, so that's five obscure Oregonians. Here's four favorite items invented in Oregon. The newspaper delivery tube, that's right, late 20s. In Jefferson, Oregon, a delivery boy named Glenn Cobb was tired of having to go up farm lanes and drop the newspapers on porches, so he started building wooden boxes, and his brother, Claire, upgraded them using sheet metal, thus the newspaper delivery tube. I'm not sure that there's going to be a big demand for those in the future. Number two, of course, is the Fosbury Flop high jump style, invented by Dick Fosbury in Medford, Oregon. As a high school kid, he was a terrible high jumper, and so suddenly he literally turned his back on the establishment and jumped over the bar backwards, came to Oregon State. Bernie Wagner, the coach there, honed his style, and in 1968, Fosbury won the gold medal. And since then, nobody's done any other style but the Fosbury Flop. The Marion Berry, 1956, by George Waldo, a Salem-based USDA horticulturist. Officially, it was called the U.S. Oregon number 927. But when I go to the restaurant, I never order that because they never quite know what I'm talking about. I just go for the Marion Berry Cobbler, 1956. And then, of course, Hacky Sack, 1970. Two Oregon City residents, Mike Marshall and John Stahlberger, invented Hacky Sack. Okay, three obscure Oregon places that I've been. The Alvord Desert, east of Steens Mountain. It's about as far from here as you can get, and it's as desolate as you can get. And when we went with this other couple, we had a flat tire that day. And you're pretty far from a Les Schwab, but the amazing thing is, it happened about noon, and we were at a Les Schwab in Burns. We got cell coverage maybe 3 hours later after using our spare tire. About 3 hours later, we got cell coverage and notified the Les Schwab in Burns that we were coming right about 5 o'clock, and they closed at 5, and they stayed open until about 10 after 5, three guys, and fixed our tire. Only in Oregon can that happen. But number two would be Greenhorn. I visited this eastern Oregon town in 2001, population zero. An amazing place. No traffic jams, no fights over where they have to widen, you know, how they're going to reshape Willamette Street or anything like that. There's just nothing there. It's just a bunch of elk hunting cabins. And then three, Flora, Oregon. I decided on my way back from Boise, it'd be fun to stay in the farthest northeast place in the state of Oregon that you could stay. Not just throwing my sleeping bag out, but a bed and breakfast or a motel or hotel or whatever. It turned out to be a ghost town called Flora. It was a haunted house, I found out the next morning when I told her, my guest, that I had a hard time sleeping, and they told me about how a young woman had committed suicide in that room. I'm glad they told me in the morning. My two favorite places in Oregon, one, of course, would be the Cascade Mountains. I love them. In 1999, I had hiked Little Belknap Crater up there by the D-Wright Observatory, and I was coming down waiting for my brother-in-law when I saw a woman hiking from south to north, and so we were chatting, and I said, well, where did you start? And she said, you mean today or in the beginning? And I said, well, in the beginning. She said, well, I started in Mexico. Okay, and where are you finishing? She said, well, Canada. Okay, this is probably not the moment to brag about having bagged Little Belknap Crater. Her name was Laura Buell. She was a U of O student. Ironically enough, on this particular day, she had left in April. It was a 5-month trip. And on this particular day, she was closer to Eugene than she would ever be. I mean, and that's where she was from. And she did the whole 2,650-mile PCT. And I was just absolutely amazed by that story. And she was the fourth column that I wrote at the Register Guard. Because when she got back in September, she arrived exactly on the day that she predicted she would in mid-September at the Canadian border. She partied for a day in Seattle and came to Oregon U of O, started classes Monday morning. I said, what was your first class? She said, 8 a.m., jogging. But I've always been inspired by Laura Buell, and I think that I kind of tucked that thought away, that someday I might want to do something like that, and I knew I couldn't do the entire thing, but 2011, my brother-in-law and I managed to do the Oregon portion, 453 miles, about 18 miles a day. And it's just beautiful, beautiful to see. It's kind of, I describe it as being off stage at a Broadway play. You're seeing it from a different angle. You're not just seeing the Three Sisters from, you know, Highway 97 in Bend or something like that. You're on the shoulder of Mount Tielson, and it's just an amazing experience, and an amazingly difficult experience too. My feet are still hurting. And my other favorite place, anybody guess? Bingo. Yeah, Yahats. In 1936, my grandfather, Ben Schumacher, bought a cabin for $500. About a mile north of Yahats, and our families, the the beneficiary of that all these years later, although it had to be rebuilt about 10 years ago. My mom's been going there. She's 86. She's been going there since she was 7. We've had 6 generations of our family going to that spot, and it's kind of my still place in a changing world. I love Yahats. And I wanted to just share my favorite Oregon story, not that I wrote it, but because of the subject of it, and that's Ken Kesey. Said, what I like best about Ken Kesey has nothing to do with psychedelic buses or LSD or merry pranksters. What I like best about Kesey was his words, specifically the way those words brought to life Oregon, the state he loved and in whose cool, moist soil his body was lowered Wednesday afternoon. The Oregon author, icon, and 60s guru died Saturday at age 66 after surgery to remove a tumor on his liver. Kesey loved this land with an old blend of respect and irreverence that showed up best in his 1964 book, Sometimes a Great Notion. It's about a bitter strike in a small lumber town near the Oregon coast, and in particular, the involvement of one family, Henry Stamper's family. Early on, Kesey describes the return of one of the Stamper boys, Leland, to Oregon. As the bus, a different bus, rickety and uncomfortable, begin the climb from Eugene into the long range of mountains that separates the coast from the Willamette Valley and the rest of the continent, he found himself becoming more alert and excited. He watched the green stand of mountains build before him, the densening of ditch growth, the clear, silver-shrouded clouds moored to the earth by straight and thin strands of autumn smoke. You can't read this book without realizing Kesey was alert and excited about Oregon, not in a jump up and down sense, but in a quiet, almost mysterious sense, like someone who knew things others did not, like someone who understood this place, at least the old rural pre-factory outlet version, better than most. Kesey was no Johnny-come-lately love of the land. He moved to a farm near Springfield in 1943, nor was it the stuff of Ray Atkinson coffee table books or tourism brochures whose photographs never show rain. It was more honest and objective and deeply rooted than such varieties. You must go through a winter to understand, he writes. Is there a better description of trying to comprehend Oregon's rain? Or for that matter, Oregon itself. It was as if Kesey and Oregon were one, like salt water and fresh water at a river's mouth, nothing to define where one started and the other ended, but clearly part of one another. Kesey had to be from Oregon, had to emerge from the primordial valley mud, as if his ilk could survive nowhere else. As you look at the photograph in last Sunday's Register Guard, Kesey, the moss-draped bust and his farm's dense woods, what strikes you is that all three seem somehow organic, as if alive and part of one another. It's an earth-tone collage of things grown old, memories mulched by time, change, and the proverbial constant. Kesey considered both people and place actors on life's stage. To him, Oregon wasn't just a state of the Union, it was a living, breathing character all its own. And so then were its trees, water, and weather. She's a brute, she is, says an old-timer in Notion about the Wakanda-Aga River. She got my house last winter and my barn this, my gum, swallowed her up. In Kesey's Oregon, nature was alive. He wrote of how unruly mobs of young clouds gather in the bright blue sky, riotous and surging, full of threat that convinces no one. In Kesey's Oregon, fog couldn't simply be some meteorological term. Instead, fog creeps down the river and winds around the base of the house, eating at the new yellow-grained planks with a soft white mouth. Kesey's Oregon was much like Kesey himself, full of independence, rough-hewn realness, and brooding darkness, known to explode at winter's end into day-glow delight. With his death, Kesey leaves an Oregon far different from the one he found in 1943. The population has more than tripled. The customer in the Sea Breeze Cafe is less likely to be a logger in suspenders ordering coffee black than a mountain biker in REI shorts ordering a vanilla latte. But for all of Hank Stamper's never-give-an-inch defiance, Kesey understood that nature bats last, even in matters of life and death. Dust to dust, ultimately, the earth takes us back. I say there was no permanence, wrote Kesey in a passage that twines life in general with the Oregon he loved. Even the town was temporary. I say it, all vanity and vexation of the spirit. One generation passeth away, and another cometh, but the earth abideth forever, or as forever as the rain lets it. So I just applaud him as somebody who helped us really understand the Oregon that no longer is in many ways, and in some ways still is. But now I'm going to segue from Oregon to just a few things that I learned along the journey of journalism in my almost 40 years. And the first would be would just be how many amazing people we have in this state. I was once back in Boston, Massachusetts, and somebody asked an interesting question after talk. Who's the most courageous person you ever interviewed? And I thought of all the World War II people that I've interviewed. I've done 3 books on that. And he instinctively instead said, Katie Barr. And they said, well, who's Katie Barr? And I said, Katie Barr was a teacher at Pleasant Hill High School. Her husband was a counselor there, and they had a 2-year-old daughter and a dog. And one day when they were driving up Highway 58 toward the school, a pickup truck swerved across the center line, hit their vehicle, and in an instant, Katie Barr lost all that was most important to her, her husband, her daughter, and her dog. If I'd gone through that experience and could have gotten out of bed a year later, it would have been a miracle. Katie Barr started the McCurdy Foundation for the slip through the crack kids in rural areas who don't have a lot of support at home, the type of kids that her husband was so passionate about helping as a counselor. There's now almost 200 mentors in Cottage Grove and Pleasant Hill who meet with these kids, start when they're in grade school and follow them through grade school, middle school, and high school. And they've already had the first class graduate to give these kids the support that they don't have. Katie Barr is just amazing. I've always liked to write about people who aren't in the spotlight but deserve it. I think of Ellen Schlesinger, a woman down here in the Whitaker area who insisted on having a memorial service for a homeless man. And I went to the service. There were 5 people there. And I think that's important stuff. I've never liked press conferences. I've never liked interviewing famous people. I've always just been enthralled with the people who toil in the shadows and who make a community a better place. And we've got lots of them here. I've seen some of you. I won't identify you, but you're here, and I know you. I think of David Robertson, a guy down in the Whitaker neighborhood who loads up coffee and sandwiches to give to the homeless in that area. And when you ask why he does it, he says, we're just doing what we think Jesus would be doing. What else have I learned? I've learned that when I look back at the people that I've interviewed who seemed most content in their life, they were people who were giving themselves to something bigger than they were. I have no time for people who are just wrapped up in their own lives and making money or being famous. I just am impressed with people who give to causes and will make sacrifices, again, to help the community the country be a better place instead of just, furthering their own personal cause. And there's the list is too long of the people that I've interviewed who fit that. The other thing I've learned is how much we need to laugh. I used to do humor kind of as a, I'd feel guilty, like if I didn't have anything else, I'd use humor. And here's what I started learning is people really like that. I mean, it would be, Don, you know what this is like. It's Monday. You did not spend the weekend thinking about what you were going to write for Tuesday. You spent the weekend, having a life, and you're driving to work on Monday, and you're going, oh, my gosh, I haven't a clue what I'm writing for tomorrow. And so we usually go to our comfort zones as authors. We go to our comfort zones in those tough places, and for me, that's humor. So sometimes I would write about, Saturday, my wife asked me if I could change this light bulb, and 6 hours later, $147 and a new light fixture later, I got the job done. And, I hate to just write about that. And then people would say, I was having a terrible day, and that made me laugh, and thank you. And so I guess, while I felt guilty doing it, people respond to humor. I once wrote a column. I have a friend who hunts. And I don't get hunting. And I told him that. I said, Jason, one of these days I'm going to write a column that begins, I don't get hunting. I'm going to start it with that sentence. He said, you would never do that. You'd just get slammed. And so one October, it was a Tuesday, I didn't have a column. And I started a column, I don't get hunting. I'm not philosophically opposed to it. I just don't understand why people would do it. So I got about 300 emails from hunters who do get it. and want me desperately to get it. And so I took up an invitation to go to the Blue Mountains and spend a week hunting. And this is not pull the Winnebago over to the side of the road and stick the gun out the window kind of hunting. This is like get on horses and mules and pack all your stuff in those like Civil War tents and cast iron stoves and stuff. I mean, this is serious stuff. I mean, I remember at the trailhead, the guys from the camp came down on their horses, and I had just arrived, and there's a guy up this horse. He looks like something from Legends of the Fall. You know, they've got the bandanas over there. And there I am with a royal blue duffel bag that's got a Walmart flashing emergency beacon in it that my wife insisted that I take. And the guy says, "That your stuff?" You know, it's kind of like being the kid at the sleepover with got the Flintstone pajamas, you know. You're going to get made fun of, but yeah, that's my stuff. And he said, "Got anything else?" I said, "Well, nothing other than we might want to notify Life Flight that that I'm here." And the guy goes, "Don't laugh. Last week, guy shot himself in the leg up there. Died." Okay. But anyway, I actually went back for another week 5 years later. It was a fascinating experience. And that's what's been so fun about being a journalist is that you get to see close up parts of life that you would never see. And I'm convinced that elk hunting has nothing to do with elk. It just doesn't. It's all about big guys being little kids again. It's about escape. It's about tradition. But it's got nothing to do with elk. Same way, so my wife, after my second trip, she says, "Well, you know, you spend 2 weeks elk hunting. Why don't you come to one of my quilt camps up the McKenzie?" I said, "I'll come to a quilt camp." So I spent a weekend at a quilt camp. Let me tell you, there's hardly any difference between elk camp. It's a little more, okay, there's a little more drinking at the quilt camp, I admit. Here's the difference between elk camp and quilt camp. At quilt camp, you see elk. Seriously, I spent 2 weeks at elk camp and never saw a live elk. And I spent 3 days at quilt camp and I saw dozens of elk up on the hill behind that basketball center up there. But we all have a lot more in common than we think. You know, on the left and the right, you know, I know that we disagree on ideas, but people are people, and that we have a lot more in common than we might otherwise think. The other thing is, what I've learned is that people respond to the heart. When you write something that's vulnerable, that you write something that involves poignancy and feeling, people relate to that. And I think it's because we live in a serious world. That's why they relate to humor, because there's not enough of it. And we live in a world that we get going so fast that we forget the heart stuff. So when you write about something poignant, people respond to it. I wrote about a piece. My daughter-in-law had a tough upbringing, and her father committed suicide when she was 10, right there at the family home, and she's had a rough life, but she's an amazing young woman. And I wrote a column talking about a U of O student who was getting married and how she had this rough life, and her mom grabbed her arm as they headed down the aisle together to the young man in front of the church waiting to marry her, my son, Jason. And that was the first point in the column that I mentioned that I was talking about my daughter-in-law on the very last line. And I got more response to that than probably anything that I've ever written. I spent an afternoon with a mother who lost a son in Iraq. I spent an afternoon at the Springfield Memorial Cemetery with her. And people responded to that. Because, you know, for those of us who don't know that soldier who died in Iraq, we feel the pain when we see the story in the paper, but the next day we get on with our lives, and we didn't know that young man, so we don't miss him, but the pain never goes away for a mom or a dad or a grandmother or grandfather or a brother or sister. And I think that it's important that we remember that. And I think it's important when you talk about war that you remind people what happens in war. People said, "How are you different than after you wrote American Nightingale about the first nurse to die after the landings at Normandy?" I said, I'm more opposed to war than ever, and I'm more amazed at the people what they've gone through when they have to go fight those wars. And it leaves you differently than it found you. I think of Bill Kunkel. He's a guy we featured in our World War II Pearl Harbor four-day series, 70-day anniversary of the the U.S.'s involvement in World War II. Bill Kunkel's a guy from Harrisburg who, back in 1942, was sent to Pearl Harbor a few months after the bombings, and he was a naval medic. And all he did, all he saw day after day were burned soldiers. And he would just break down in tears during the interviews and say, I couldn't save any of them. I couldn't help any of them. And after 3 months, they had to ship him back to the United States because he was so distraught. He got an honorable discharge, don't get me wrong, but he's never been the same. And so last Memorial Day, Bill Kunkel wandered into a service that I was speaking at three services during the day. And the last one was out there on West 11th at the Musgrove Cemetery out there. And before the event got going, Musgrove came up and said, "Sir, we understand that you were a World War II vet, and we'd like to present, after the soldiers go through the ceremonial folding of the flag, we'd like to present it to you." And it was an amazing moment. Me? Because, you know, he never thought he did anything. But I'll tell you what, you know, he did do something. He went off and he went through hell for his country. And when they handed him that flag, it was just a beautiful moment that I probably would never have seen had I not been a reporter and been there. And so, and then the Willamette High singers were singing. They were right off to the side. I was in the front row next to Bill, and the singers were there. And as they were singing these moving songs, patriotic songs, Bill's eyes were tearing up. And then the girls, many of the girls and some of the guys were tearing up as well, the singers. And I was right in the middle of a relationship that was forming through songs, through words of songs and music. And it was beautiful. And at the end of it, this young girl came down and she just looked at him. She says, "I don't even know you, but can I just please get a hug?" And she gave this man a hug. And it was a special moment. So heart stuff matters. And just finally to close, I would just say another thing I learned from people I interviewed was no risk, no reward. No risk, no reward. You got to take some chances. You got to make some changes. That's probably what led me to leave the Register Guard. I think I had the best job in town. I always thought I was, and Don probably felt the same way, that I was privileged. I got to decide what I was going to write. I knew exactly how long it needed to be, when it was due. I didn't have to go to meetings. I didn't have to arrange things with photographers. It was the best job going. But when you've been in the newspaper business for 37 years and your life is just always deadline after deadline. It is, as I use the analogy, a little bit like running across a farmer's field in front of a combine. A heck of a lot of fun, a little bit exhilarating until you trip just once. And I've started feeling like I was getting ready to trip. And so no regrets. Great experience. The best part of it all was my relationship with people who let me tell their stories, and my relationship with readers who were just so much fun to just open up reader response things. Let's name Rame. Let's see if we can name this notch in the Coburg Hills. And that's what I will miss the most about it. So anyway, with that, is it question time? That's right. You always grill me at this thing. Thank you.
But first, we'll take a short break for you to compose questions as a table, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, at 88.1, KLBR Bend, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and on the web, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club program on Farewell to Newspapers, What I Learned from Four Decades on the Beat, by Bob Welch. And now to your questions.
My name is Arnold Ismack, and I've been a member of City Club since 1898.
I thought it was longer than that, Arnold.
That's just the way I look.
Okay.
But you gave us a big dose of comedy today, which we appreciated. Mm-hmm. And you also indicated your love for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But something you didn't get into that's on everybody's mind is our local daily newspaper, the Register Guard. What do you think of the Register Guard today with the reductions in staff and space that's been going on? How does it compare to other mid-sized dailies in the country? And what do you think the future of the paper is?
Okay. When I was a student at the University of Oregon in the 70s, I think the Register Guard was in its golden years. The 70s and the 80s were just amazing. There was money, there was passion. Amazing things got done. They were winning. Every year they would win the best in state versus the Oregonian. They were considered the best mid-sized paper in the country. In years since, I don't think it's what it once was, Arnold. But I do think, and I hear this often from people, when you go other places, when you're on an airplane and you've gone to an airport and you pick up their paper, a lot of people say, you know what, we've got a pretty decent paper in Eugene, and it's cool that it's still family-owned. Is it as good as it once was? No. Does it do as much investigative reporting as it once did? No. And I'll tell you why, because when you go to the Register Guard, everybody's been moved upstairs, and Dairy Mart is downstairs, and the Safe Corporation is downstairs. They're leasing out part of their... It's getting smaller. There's fewer subscribers. There's less ads, and there's less money to pay people. And so you can only do what you can do when you have that kind of money. And I just know that, I think Diane Deese does some really nice investigative pieces, but we don't have a big staff that can go out and do what we used to be able to do. And I think that that's sad, but that's kind of the reality of our times. Yeah. Not what you wanted to hear, but yes, Marilyn.
Hi, Bob. So should the Register Guard, if they decide to do a search and find a new columnist... never to replace you, but, new columnist.
They can replace me. That's no problem.
If they do that, what qualities would you recommend they include in their search criteria?
Good question. What qualities should the Guard include? I think it needs to be somewhat... Well, let's take Don and I. I mean, a lot of a columnist is who you are as a human being, what you value, what your passions are, what you're good at. And sometimes, like Don Bischoff, he knew Eugene like nobody knew Eugene. And he knew, and he could tell the city council how they should do their business. And he was right most of the time. That was his passion. He was political and he loved it. And he had all those sources. When I took over for Don, I'd said, if you want another Don Bischoff, don't hire me because I'm not like him. I don't have that passion. I don't have that skill that he has. Here's what I would do. I really am fascinated by people, by places, and I think that humor, and I have to admit a little bit of sports, more than a little. So I think, I don't necessarily think that they would probably have a criteria and say, you must fit this. I think they should say, cast the net and say who comes in that net and what could they bring to our community. I think somebody different from Bob Welch would be wonderful because you've had 14 years. That's a big dose of one person, and so I'd look what those person's strengths are. But I definitely think they need to care about their community, care about people, and be able to help us understand the place that we live. Wow, there's a long line here. It looks like a bus,
I'm Ross Stein, City Club member. Huh? Basically, Arnold was asking the question our table was interested in, but I think I even want more than that. You've been in the newspaper business almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. What do you see for newspapers in the next 40 years? And is there any, have any advice for newspaper people?
What do we see? What do I see for the future of the next 40 years? I'm an optimist by nature, as you well know. I tend to see the, glass is always half full. But I don't think the glass is half full for the hard copy newspaper. I think that it's going away. I just think it's inevitable. And people will always say, yeah, but I love reading the paper. I love the feel of it. I do it every morning. I get that. I'm the same way. But I'm also one of those 55 and older people. My son's generation, for every 85-year-old person who passes away, there is not a 25-year-old person who comes in and subscribes to replace that person. For every 70-year-old person who goes out of business. There's not a 30-year-old who's coming in and buying his or her advertising to replace it. It's just not happening. My son is a videographer. His community is the world. His advertising is free. It's on the web. It's on the internet. It's on Twitter. And he flies around taking videos. The world's changing. And as much as people like me, I'm a little house on the prairie kind of guy. And I'm a Norman Rockwell guy. I love all that, but it's changing, and you either have to some degree, accept that and move on or be bitter the rest of your life, because that's the way the world works. And so I think the hard copy newspaper is going away. I tell my journalism students at UVO, you're going to have to reinvent journalism. We desperately need it in a free society. If we don't have people going out and holding up a mirror and saying, look what your city council's doing. Look how the school district's spending your money. Look what the people in Washington, D.C. are doing with your values. We are in deep doo-doo. And so we need journalism, but we got to figure out a way to repackage it and pay the people to do it. I hear over and over people will say, oh, well, I just read it on the internet. We don't need newspapers. Okay, so who is the person on the internet accountable to? In other words, the Register Guard is not a perfect newspaper, but you know what? If I'm biased, if I spell enough people's names wrong, I'm going to get fired. There's accountability. And when you're just somebody on the internet, you don't have to really be accountable for anyone. So, again, I think it's going to get reinvented in the next generation, and we desperately need journalism, but we've got to find a way to pay for it, too. So, yes, sir.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. A couple of preliminary remarks before the question. I'm an immigrant, not one of the original mm-hmm. Oregonians. And when we got here, I really noticed what I thought was a difference in the kind of people that I ran into. And I used to think, well, maybe they are the descendants of the people who came here on the covered wagon, and they're just a different type of people sort of thing. And I'm reminded of this as I go down the street or I'm coming out of the parking lot of Safeway, for instance, and there's a long line of traffic and someone will wave me in. Hmm. And I've seen that difference kind of thing from other places in Oregon or certainly across the country. And I'm wondering, with all of the people you've met, do you see a difference in Oregonians or in Eugenians than other places?
You know, I want to say yes, but here's what I've learned when I travel other places. There's a lot of nice people in the world. I love Oregon, but I'm amazed that I'll be in some other city or town, I'll just go, wow, I could live here. I went to upstate New York for the first time in December. And in a little place called Seneca Falls. They had a wonderful life festival there that I got to be part of. And then just traveling around upstairs. And they're beautiful places, and there's lots of nice people. I think it'd be going too far to say Oregonians are all friendly. We actually once did a Q&A with a reader response. Are Eugenians, are people around here friendly? And it was interesting. About half the people said, yeah, they're really, really friendly. And about half of them said, oh, my gosh. You are so standoffish. I move here. The woman came over. The first thing she said to me was, "Do you recycle?" I mean, so I don't know that Oregonians are any more friendly or Eugenians are any more friendly. I think that Eugene. What I love about Eugene is there is a distinctiveness here. The hippie element, the running element. There's a quirkiness about this place that I've always said if you can't write about this place and have some fun with it, you can't write about any place and have fun with it. So, but I'm not going to go out and say, yeah, we're friendlier than other places. So,
Bob, Joel Curran, City Club member for 2 years. Our table is obviously a little bit less serious than the other tables. There is an expression about marriage, for better or for worse, but not for lunch. How's your wife handling having you home 24/7?
Thank you for the reprieve. How's my wife handling it? You know what? She was, I noticed in the last few months before my retirement, she started making some comments, and I said, are you worried about this not working out? She goes, well, I'm just, you know, I've kind of got my old pattern at home, and you know, you're going to be, you've kind of had your pattern elsewhere. It's really worked out pretty well because I'm, she's on the go quite a bit, and I try to get out. I go to, you know, when I want to grade my papers, for example, for U of O, I go out to Vector's Coffee Shop there on Chad Drive where I used to hang out, and it's just a nice people. I know some people there, and so I try to get out of the house, and I'm leaving Sunday. I'll go over to Yahat for 4 days by myself and just immerse myself in getting ready for writing four new workshops for our February 28th event over in Yahat. And then, you know, we do some travel together. But so far, I think she's been surprised at how well it's working. And she says, I'm more relaxed. And people that I've talked to say the same thing, like, wow, you just seem more relaxed. And I think it's because I'm more relaxed. But, yes.
Hi, I'm Jody Summers, mm-hmm. and I'm a City Club member. Mm-hmm. And everyone at my table, we're all subscribers to the Register mm-hmm. Guard. We all appreciate it. We talked a lot about the local news, and those people who have been reading it longer than I have and have been around the community longer were talking about how local coverage has decreased mm-hmm. and that what we're seeing now is more prevalence of crime stories, local crime stories. And just curious about your take on that and whether you see that, is that what we're going to be stuck with from now on, just to focus on who murdered who and who's going to go to jail and who's going to testify?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you note that because in reading the paper, not as a columnist, but just as a reader, I too have been... I've had that same thought. Like, it seems like we just always have a mugshot of some weird looking person who just beat somebody up. There's a lot of that going on. And is that because there's more of that happening, or is the paper consciously deciding to run more of that kind of news? I think when you don't have a large staff, I think you go to what's easiest, and police blotters, what happened in the crime scene is, I'm taking nothing away from our police reporter, Jack Moran, who does an excellent job, but I think that that's accessible information in a hurry, whereas feature sections and stuff, that takes real creativity. You have to be planning ahead, thinking ahead, and I mean, when I was features editor in the mid to late 90s, I had a staff of 12 people. There are now two people in the feature section of the Register Guard, and I don't know how else to say it. I think that shows. It isn't as creative. You don't see them going out. I mean, I think every few often on a Sunday, you should open your Sunday front page and be surprised and go, oh, that's an interesting idea. And maybe it isn't a big, deep think piece about, you know, Willamette Street or what are we going to do with the Civic Stadium. Or it's something that just sort of surprises us. And I'd like to see more of that stuff myself. Yes.
Thanks, Bob. Mm-hmm. Rob Zaka, City Club member. You said no risk, no reward. Mm-hmm. And so this question is an invitation for you to stick your neck out a little bit.
Okay.
You don't have a boss to answer to.
Okay.
You mentioned South Willamette Street and Eugene. You mm-hmm. talked about Oregon's bottle bill. Mm-hmm. Can you pick something where you think the city of Eugene or maybe Oregon on its birthday could be doing better and offer some advice if you were king or mayor or governor or something like that?
Oh, wow. What could we be doing better? You know, I think on different levels than a lot of people. I think, you know, I think sometimes we, how do I say this? I think we sometimes expect our elected officials out there to do everything for us. And I think that we, in expecting so much of them, I think we ignore our own individual responsibility. With this recent storm, I heard all these stories about people helping out other people, and I think that I'm a totally idealistic person, but I just think that in addition to expecting stuff from our leaders, we got to expect stuff from ourselves. When is the last time you want your civic leaders to do this and this and make these sacrifices? When is the last time you did something for your community? And again, I think this is a pretty amazing community in terms of people stepping up and getting involved, but I think that we could just do a whole lot more of that too. It's just about being responsible citizens ourselves and helping this be a better place. So
Hi, I'm Mary Layton, also recently retired and not yet bumping into my husband at lunch. I read somewhere, and I keep thinking it must be the Register Guard, but I can't remember exactly, that you become a journalist not because you want to write or you love writing, but because you're curious.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered where you fell. I read your column all the time, and it struck me that you were storytelling, but I didn't know you maybe in investigative days or how much investigation. So where do you fall in that question?
I think that's totally true. I tell my journalism classes, I said, if you don't wonder about the world around you, if you're not curious, if you don't ask questions, if you don't meet somebody and wonder, you know, I wonder who this person is and where they were, I mean, you shouldn't be a journalist, because I think that journalism is about curiosity on all sorts of levels. Curiosity as to, you know, again, how the government's spending our money. Curiosity about, you know, the billboard out on Beltline that says, Lordy, Lordy, Mary turned 40. Who's Mary? Who is that woman? And that's what led to the start of the Q&A column, actually, where I just started getting a few questions from readers. I ran the Q&A, and then all of a sudden said, oh, there's a Q&A column. So people started sending me in Q&A questions. But people, I do think you have to have that curiosity. And I think it's kind of inbred in you pretty early in your life. Either you're that way or you're not. I was, you know, at 7 years old, I knew, like on career day when in fifth grade, I went and interviewed Oregon State's basketball coach. I wanted to be a reporter. I've always known that. The thing that is hardest about teaching young people today is I have 16 kids in my class, and I don't feel that much passion for them wanting to go out and be journalists. And part of it, I could cut them some slack on two things. Number one, They haven't been working on their high school papers because they don't have a high school paper like I did in the 70s. And the other thing is they don't know what the future is. I knew I was going to come to the U of O, going to study journalism, going to get a job at a newspaper. They don't know what they're going to get a job doing. They don't even know what the future looks like. And so I kind of cut them some slack. But I just wish there were a little bit more curiosity, a little bit more passion in that generation.
Dave Popple. Been a member since, I don't know, sometime. Uh-huh. Anyway, I have three kids. They're 41, 43, and 53. Not one of them takes a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
They don't watch news much. And they say they can get anything they want online. But if they go online, they go look for a specific thing.
Right.
What I find with a newspaper is I could go to a page and I'll find 2, 3, 4, 5 stories that I would never known if it wasn't for the newspaper. Is there going to be anything in our future, or your children talking to you, do they see any answer to that?
Right.
That's my biggest concern.
Makes a great point about at least the newspaper. The newspaper, like on an editorial page, they'll often will have a pro or con. They'll have letters to the editor that show two different thoughts. That's what your club's all about, right? Okay, debate, getting, you know, talking about issues. And that really worries me, because the more choices we get, you know, there's talk of newspapers, you know, that the 97401 paper could be different than a 97402 paper. I mean, with technology, we you know, you could say, you know, some down the future, you could say, okay, I only want this in my paper. I don't want any sports. I don't want any Bob Welch metaphors dealing with sports. He can write his column, but extract all those. No, I'm going a little bit farther. But we get it, and it's good for us individually. We think it's good for us because we get just what we want. But what do we lose when we don't hear an opposing point of view? Exactly. No, I think you make a good point. I don't know what the solution to that is, because with technology, we get more and more exactly what we think we want, not what we need necessarily. So.
Well, thank you, Bob Welch, for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Oakley Meadows Co-Housing, and KRVM, and a belated welcome to our new member, City Councilor Claire Surrette. We meet again next Friday on February 21st at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear how are young ducks growing their own businesses. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you for coming today.